Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for dialing in today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to remind everyone that the fall dates for the How Fundraising Really Works Roadshow are confirmed. You can find those dates on my website at lewisfundraising.com/events. Our next stop will be in New York City on Thursday, October 10th. We are very grateful to Jennifer Kearney and the entire advancement team at the Gateway School for generously volunteering their beautiful location just blocks from Lincoln Center and Central Park. Keep in mind that seating is limited to 40 and we are expecting to sell out for this particular event. If you would like more information about this upcoming event at the Gateway School in New York City, please go to my website at lewisfundraising.com/events. I do want to introduce my guest this morning. Holly Moon is the second half. Second half meaning that she is the one of two of the fundraising team for the Lions Eye Institute for Transplant and Research. She is an advocate for young fundraising professionals and serves her local AFP chapter through committee involvement and helping engage people who are new to the profession. Holly is also highly involved in the Emerging Leaders of Tampa Bay and serves on the board of directors for her local community. Holly is a good friend of mine with Ian, and I think it was Ian that introduced us. Holly, would you mind just introducing yourself?
Yeah. So my name is Holly, and I am in my third year as a full-time fundraiser. I fell in love with fundraising when I was in college, and I've striven towards that goal ever since. And since then, I've learned a lot about the sector and especially how it impacts young professionals. So I'm constantly trying to see how we can do better for our young professionals. And so this book appealed to me because there's a lot of, problems in our sector with engaging young professionals and keeping them involved that I think really speaks to that.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your work. What is it you do on the day to day? And then we'll jump into that, to your appreciation. I certainly appreciate your enthusiasm about the book, but let's hear a little bit more about you, Holly.
Sure. So I'm, as you said, I'm one of two people at the Lions Eye Institute for Transplant and Research. Together, my supervisor and I, we make up the foundation. And so because we're such a small shop, I do a lot of different things and I get a lot of opportunities that young professionals may not always get to have. And so I basically oversee our two major fundraising events, our Rotary Ebor 5K race and our Eyeball, which this year the theme is See and Be Seen. That's our signature gala. I also help with soliciting in-kind gifts and sponsorships and developing relationships with our donors. A large part of it is because we are a Lions project, as I do maintain the relationship with our local Lions and all over the state of Florida. I help a lot with our marketing and social media. I think a large part of that is because of my youth, but I do have a marketing degree. So that's helpful and things like that.
Yeah. So when you, every time I have the opportunity to talk to a young fundraising professional, I'm always intrigued by the enthusiasm with which younger fundraisers tend to own the identity of being a fundraiser. When you introduce yourself, do you say to someone, "Hey, I'm a fundraiser," or do you introduce yourself another way?
It kind of depends on who I'm speaking with. Uh-huh. If if I know I'm in a room of people who are scared of the word fundraiser,
okay.
I might tell people I'm a fund development professional. However, I generally do introduce myself as a fundraiser very proudly.
Yeah, right. Okay. And if you were talking to a major donor, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, if they're a major donor, I'd tell them my actual title, just foundation coordinator. And I would explain to them exactly what it is I do at the foundation.
Right. Okay. Okay. Right. So Holly, you read the book, and one of the things that, when you and I connected on social media, one of the things that that resonated with you that admittedly, I don't think I've taught in 80 plus episodes. I don't think I've talked to anyone about is these three personalities. And so when you reached out and I thought, hey, I haven't talked about motives research. I'm sorry. I've only had one cup of coffee this morning. I thought this would be a great opportunity to discuss that. So, of those three personalities that I describe in the back of the book in a development office, which one do you think you most identify with?
I am unquestionably a how am I doing?
How am I doing? So if you're a how am I doing, that means you're a high achiever.
Yes.
So if and one of the things that we know about implicit motives research, that's where all that stuff comes from. That wasn't a lot of the only original thought in there for me was that I gave it some creative names. But if you're a high achiever, that means that your spouse or a partner or a friend or somebody meaningful in your life would also describe you that way. Would they tell you that as well?
Yes, 100%.
Because one of the things that those the people who sort of came up with that research, the psychologists and everybody behind that, is that other people tend to be a better read of these implicit motives than we are. So who, I don't know, what significant person in your life, how would they describe you?
Sure. My partner's name is Derek, and I live together, and I'm always 100% career-driven, and he's a manager for a local paint store. And so our jobs are very different in that way. And so my job often takes me to do all these different extra curricular type activities to build relationships and build a profile on the community and things like that, that are foreign to him in a lot of ways. And so I would definitely say that he would say that I need to spend more time at home relaxing. But I'll probably never be that way.
Yeah. So, how would you describe, let's get to know him a little bit before we, how would you describe him if he was a fundraising professional and of the three personalities that we described there in that book, how would you describe him?
Oh my goodness. He's going to hate that I'm talking about him. I would guess that he would be an I'll lead the way. He's more driven and wanting to take charge. I mean, he's a manager, so he does oversee,
sure,
you know, people.
Yep.
He wants to achieve as well as I do, but he knows that there is you know, he's either going to be successful or he's not, and he's going to do what it takes to be successful at his job. And he's going to take control of the things that he needs to in order to achieve that.
Yeah. So of the three personalities, the ones that I tend to see the most, so, you're saying that you're a, how am I doing type personality, and you're saying he's a lead the way type personality. So if the two of you were actually working in a development office, I would tend to say that you two are actually in the minority, but I think a lot of people who are in these fundraising offices, tends to be this let's work together personality. Have you ever worked with a let's work together?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My previous organization, we had a lot of program people specifically who tend to be let's work together.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. So the let's work together people tend to be those types that I think we see gravitate towards nonprofit work. They like to work with other people. They like to be collaborative. Relationships are at the top of their list. But they also tend to be the people who fear rejection and tend to fear the idea of, the idea that anything that they might do might mess up the relationship, any sort of decision that they might make. So consequently, the idea, for example, of asking them for money, always runs the risk that, I might, cross a line that I shouldn't cross. Have you ever sort of observed that?
I think so. Yeah. I've had this conversation with many fundraisers, especially through AFP and whatnot, but there's a lot of fundraisers who are afraid to ask for money. And I don't have a problem so much of it, especially as I get more practice asking for money. If they say no, they say no. It doesn't make me feel too bad about it. And, if somebody ends up with their feelings hurt, which does happen on occasion, you work on mending it afterwards, but I don't think, I don't feel afraid about asking them for money. That's my job.
Right. Right. Yeah. So let's work together personality is so concerned about that relationship. That underlying implicit motive is the need for affiliation, the need for really healthy relationships. And so they will do everything that they can to ensure that that relationship is not in any way harmed. But like yourself, how am I doing? Does have a darker side as well. You're very fearful of making a mistake or not achieving your goal. So where do you see, that tends to be the darker side of your personality. So where do you see that playing out in your work?
I definitely would say that that's true. especially I've been at my current position for about a year. And after leaving the organization that I had previously worked at, there was a lot of, negative, outlooks about making mistakes. Mistakes were not acceptable. It's like the opposite of the Google feelings.
Yeah.
When I started at this new job, I felt like I was walking on eggshells a lot because, I never knew what was going to happen if and when I did make a mistake. I've gotten a lot more comfortable since then, and I'm a lot more comfortable with my supervisor. And so I feel less fearful of it, but I still do get that twinge of feeling when I'm afraid that I might have messed something up.
So what is it in your work where you're actually I spend a lot of my time coaching major gifts officers. And one of the places where major gifts officers, for example, spend, in my opinion, an inordinate amount of time avoiding the possibility of a mistake is just that initial meeting. So it's making sure that all the information is right and that we know everything that we possibly can before we pick up the telephone and ask to have a cup of coffee with these folks. Is that where the risk of making a mistake happens for you, or is there somewhere else in your work where the risk is oftentimes or is maybe implied or feared?
Sure. I think that I feel more nervous when there is an established relationship either with myself or with the organization. I do feel concerned about potentially harming that in the same way that let's work together person might. But as far as the initial outreach goes, I feel less fearful about that because I don't know how much could really go wrong in a first conversation. You just say hello, you be friendly, and if they say yes, they say yes. If they say no, they say no.
Right. Well, that's probably, again, very true of your personality that
let's get to work, right? And start climbing that mountain. And if we run into roadblock, if we run into, if we stump our toe on something, you typically can overcome that. The other thing that we know about your personality, a high achiever, is that you want meaningful, substantive feedback. That's the other thing about that personality I think is particularly problematic in smaller shops, is that you have an individual who wants feedback, and not the type of feedback like pat you on the back and say, oh, you did a good job today, but actually feedback that suggests that your boss knows what, that he or she knows what you're doing, and understands that. Do you tend to get that, or have you found, has there been times when you've sort of said, you know what, I wish the feedback was a little more substantive?
Feedback, I would say my supervisor does a really good job of telling me, or letting me know, the things that she thinks that I do really well by giving me more responsibility in those things. So that's a really fortunate part. I wouldn't say that I get a ton of, feedback that are opportunities for things for me to work on. You know, one would hope that that's because I have nothing to work on, but I know that that's not the case. So I would say that I would look to my peers, and I do consult with her. She's a valued mentor for me, and I do talk to her when I run into, you know, conflicts with other fundraisers or people out in the community, or I tell her I had this weird interaction and I'm not sure what is the best way for me to go about this, or could I have done this better? I think I opened that conversation a lot more than it's open to me.
Yeah. So if you were advising at the AFP chapter that you're a part of, if you're, I've never asked this question, as it applies to these three personalities, but if you're sitting there at the lunch table at your next AFP meeting, how would you assess where these people happen to be in terms of these personality types?
I mean, I would definitely have to get to know people before,
I
could make that assessment, but I found that you learn the most through committees. So I serve on our National Philanthropy Day Committee, our programs committee, and I'm also on the committee for, a conference that we're working on that's geared towards emerging leaders in the, profession.
Yeah.
And I found that there are definitely people who are, I'll take the lead, and feel very strongly on that.
Yeah.
which is a great person to have. There are also the, you know, I don't run into too many other how am I doings, I think, but let's work together. I do get a lot of,
yeah.
Which are also wonderful to have, of course.
So I do think, yes, the nonprofit sector, I think, does have its share of I'll take the leads. I think that I'll take the leads tend to be the people who gravitate towards the CEO spots, the leadership spots, and they tend to be good leaders. But they're also very fearful. The dark side of the research that they've been doing in these personalities, motivational theories for years, is that the I'll take the lead types are very fearful of betrayal. Have you ever seen that with any one of these individuals? Maybe not I'll take the lead type that you've worked with.
Fearful of betrayal.
Yeah, they're very fearful of so the idea that, for instance, I'll take the lead implies, okay, if I'm the leader, you're the follower. And so the idea that any follower would betray them is usually their biggest. So whereas your fear is making a mistake, a meaningful mm-hmm. mistake, and whereas let's work together is very fearful of messing up a relationship, the dark side of I'll lead the way is betrayal.
Mm-hmm. I think that with other fundraisers, and I think that this is more common for fundraisers who are already in positions of authority.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, where it's kind of a funky spot in my current, you know, career path and where I'm at is that I don't currently hold a major leadership position within my organization.
Yeah.
But I have found that with fundraisers who are the the I'll lead the way type, that they can feel threatened by younger, ambitious people, which to me feels silly, because, I might be 10 years behind in my career. But I have observed that, and I think it's unfortunate, because I think that is, that takes away from giving opportunities to younger people.
Yeah, and I've encountered that as well, and I kind of wonder if sometimes they, when I do these seminars, we try to actually categorize ourselves, self-identify, I guess is the word. I don't try to determine for everyone, but I allow everyone to self-determine for themselves, self-identify which personality they happen to be. And I think it's the, I'll lead the way personality that sort of rubs people the wrong way, or they misinterpret, the usefulness or the value of this. And so maybe it's the idea that power and control, is sort of negatively perceived in the nonprofit sector. I think we've got our share of them, but I don't know that they'd like to own up to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a, when you're talking at least about these particular negative characteristics, nobody wants to live up to their, or own up to their negative characteristics. So I can understand that part, but I do think that, that's an opportunity for those people that we do have to improve upon.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that I point out in my seminar, some of the research in these implicit motives is, some of the ways that they have, researchers and psychologists have sort of figured out who some of these personalities are, is actually listening to the speeches of our presidents. And so they've listened to the speeches of, John F. Kennedy and President Obama, and obviously they've listened to most recently to President Trump's speeches. One of the things they figured out is that a really good president tends to be, some of our better presidents have historically been the I'll lead the way types. They were very diplomatic. They wanted to lead and they expected people to follow them. And what happens in the speeches is they can hear this leadership, power, control sort of language in the speeches. That's essentially how psychologists code these things, is they listen for language that correlates with these personality types. But one of the things they figured out about President Trump, is that he's actually not an I'll lead the way type, that he's actually like yourself. Whether you like President Trump or not, he's actually an achieving type individual.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that actually, so when you think about President Trump through the lens of being a high achiever rather than a high control person, you start to think through the predicament that we are with our current president slightly a little differently. Because what that means is, for example, is that he's not really worried about being betrayed. And he's not concerned about people not following him. What he's most concerned about as a high achiever is the notion that he would fail. But the other thing is that some commentators I've heard who've written along this line is this notion that, and maybe you've seen this in your own work as an achiever, is that some people thought during the election that had he lost, had he not secured the nomination, he wouldn't have really cared all that much. And that's the idea, that sometimes achievers just sort of test the boundaries, if you will. They just sort of play with the objectives, right? They're not necessarily driven to the, on the assumption that they're necessarily going to win, but they like to experiment. Do you ever find that in your own work, where you're sort of just experimenting with the possibilities?
Absolutely. I I like to, I'm big on making decisions, rather definitively and rather quickly, which I think is a good thing as well as a bad thing.
Yeah.
And I, I tend to, make those decisions, like the A/B testing and things like that. I really believe that we could do more of that as a sector. And I think that there are a lot of fundraisers who, are afraid to try new things. And I think that really impedes our progress. And so I think that if we did more trying and to see if, you know, what works and what doesn't, I think that we would have, a lot more success.
Yeah. So if you think about it, if you sort of hang on to these three personalities, and if your critique is that any one of these individuals, you know, the idea of experimentation, you know, experimenting, iteration with new ideas, it may be your personality that is the most, most inclined and most comfortable with that. Because that's really who you are. The highly relational person is very concerned that experiment might mess things up. That, you know what, if this experiment doesn't work, I'm going to let somebody down. But the high control person, I don't know that this made it into the book, Holly, but the thing that a lot of times doesn't get talked about a whole lot about the high control, high power person is they see the world as sort of a zero sum game, which is the idea that for you to win, I have to lose or vice versa. If I give you $100, then you've lost $100, you know, or you've gained $100. Now, you know, he's lost $100. And so for example, when it comes to charitable giving, there's no win-win. Whereas you and I might, and I tends to be a high achiever as well, we can actually see the win on both sides of the charitable exchange. We can see the donor experiencing some sort of a return on their investment, you know, immediately. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I initially declared myself, how am I doing? I had said that I'm also, because I always believe that you have a primary personality with all of these assessments and that you have a secondary, kind of your fallback. And I think that my fallback would be, I'll lead the way. And I felt that way because for a variety of reasons, but specifically talking about this zero-sum mindset, and I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but as a young professional and as a young lady who, you know, when I see other young women succeeding in my profession, you know, there are times when I feel competitive about that, especially if they're younger than me or have been doing things longer. But then my feminist self has to remind myself that just because they're achieving at a different rate than I am does not mean that I won't have the opportunity to achieve. So I do have to consciously disrupt my thought process when I think in that zero sum kind of way.
Yeah, you know, I have not, when I originally came across this research, and this research dates back to the pre-World War II when we were anticipating all these, in most cases, men coming back from the war, and we were figuring out, okay, how are we going to employ them and in what parts of the economy are we going to put all of them? But I have not thought through these three personalities through the lens of gender. And so it's kind of making me think, I wonder if, you know, because we know that 70-80% of the fundraisers out there, in fact, I was doing a presentation with AFP chapter the other day and it was all women. Holly, which of the three personalities do you think sort of best serves and least serves our profession when you think through the gender, when you think through the reality that 70-80% of us are women, which ones do you think probably best serves and least serves us?
That's a really tough one. I would say that immediately just because I've just talked about this, but the, the I'll lead the way and that zero-sum mindset is really it's poison to raising other women up. And I think that particular trait of that particular personality is one of the worst things that I've experienced about my peers and myself in this sector. I guess on the flip side of that, the Let's Work Together, we need as many of those kinds of people as possible who care about others. I mean, that's the primary goal for our sector, is to help other people and animals and the environment, all these wonderful things.
Sure.
I think that we need people that are concerned and feel empathy in that kind of way.
Yeah, I think, yeah, right. Again, I haven't thought through this through the gender lens, but it makes me think that, for example, women who identify as high achievers, so individuals like yourself, probably sometimes are misinterpreted as very control or power people, because you tend to be, tell me if I'm correct about this. If you're focused on the goal and you're saying, okay, we're going to achieve the goal. And so you can very pragmatically make a decision and say, okay, this is the direction we're going. You can make that decision because you're trying to achieve a goal, but that may be perceived as a control or a power motive at work there. And I would guess that depending on who it is you're working with, if they don't understand these motives at work, they might interpret that through the fact that you're a woman differently than they might. Like the high power, the high control stuff, sometimes we expect of men and we don't tend to like when we see it of women. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And actually you are hitting on a particular pet peeve of mine.
Okay, good.
As a young woman who has, one that sticks out in my mind is that another young lady had called me abrasive in an organization that I was a part of in college.
Yeah.
And that always hurt my feelings because I was like, I've never tried to intentionally hurt somebody or anything like that, but I do tend to, be very, very, very frank and direct and logic driven. And, and sometimes I don't have that conscious thought in mind. And I think you're right that for a lot of women, we're raised to believe that that's not acceptable to present themselves in that way.
But that's also that dichotomy between the other two personalities, of which you're not even really identifying with, if you think about it. Our society has sort of said to women, and you're a woman, I'm not, so you be quick to correct me. But if you think about it, the world has sort of said to women in many instances that you're supposed to be very cooperative and let's work together. So you're sort of expected to be in that collaborative middle personality, right? And we sort of hand the world off to those I'll lead the way types, the people who run for president and stuff, who happen to happen to be men. But I don't know that, I don't know that we sort of have the interesting thing about this research is that these three personalities tend to be sort of the high end on the motivational theories, sort of in this implicit motive sort of category. But there's like 26 others. So there's actually other motives mixed in there. It's just that they don't tend to be what they call the big three. You've got me thinking. Holly, I have had you. I've kept you chatting for about 25 minutes. I'm curious, before I let you go, if you were giving some advice to any one of these three personalities, or to all three of these personalities, what would your advice be?
Wow, loaded question. I guess it would be to really examine. I think it's really easy to think of ourselves and what we do well in each of our personalities and think that that's the right way. And there isn't a right way. You can be, just because you're not a how am I doing or an I'll lead the way doesn't mean you can't be an executive director, CEO, person in leadership. I would look to the other personalities and see what they're doing really well that you could work on and make better about yourself, and learn from those people. And then, you know, examine the faults that are part of your personality and see how you can improve those.
Yeah, totally. So Holly, people know how to find me. I'm on social media. They know that, hey, if there's something Jason's saying and they want to banter with me, they can certainly do that. But if somebody's heard something today, they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
I would reach out on either LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram.
Uh-huh.
Instagram and Twitter are all HollyMoon94. That's HollyMoon94. And then LinkedIn is just /HollyMoon.
Okay, Holly, it has been a pleasure. Delighted to have you on the podcast today. To my listeners, if you're unfamiliar with implicit motives and you want to know and understand your motives, you can certainly pick up a copy of my book, or you can look in the show notes, and I will have some information about these concepts in the show notes. Thank you again, Holly. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.